Good morning, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the Outdoor Connection. My guest this morning, I'm sure you'll find quite interesting, is Charles Allen, and he is the owner, proprietor, CEO, and probably sweeps the floors at Knives of Alaska. Good morning, Charles. How you doing?
I'm doing well, Rick. Good morning to you, and how are you today up there?
We're doing good. I mean, this is... We got two things to celebrate today. Number one, it's 248th birthday of the United States Marine Corps. Hoorah! And
absolutely.
As soon as I clear the studio, I am headed to deer camp, so it can't get much better than that.
No, it doesn't. That's great.
So tell everybody where you're located. Now, the company says Knives of Alaska, but you're actually located in Texas.
We're in Denison, Texas, which is right on the Oklahoma border, right north of Dallas. And the Alaska connection actually came because we were outfitters in Alaska. We had a full-service hunting and fishing lodge up in southeast Alaska, right off the coast, the Gulf of Alaska, between Cordova and Yakutat. And that's where we did all of the prototyping on our designs, field testing. And we're field testing on animals like, 1,500-pound bull moose and brown bears, coastal brown bears. So the connection came in that we were in Alaska for 28 years, and that's where we were there for only about 3 months of the year, and then we just couldn't ship steel. The shipping cost to and from Alaska would be exorbitant, and it would drive the cost of our product up. So we established our manufacturing operation in Denison.
So is Texas then where you're originally from, or that Denison area?
Yes, it is. That family home, we've been in very here good. like three generations and longer, I guess. Came in here in the 1860s and had a small farm, and this is home for me.
Well, I can understand that because I grew up in Houston, and then came to Nebraska to play football out of college and liked the area and stayed. So anyway, back to the knives. How did you just don't wake up in the morning and say, I'm going to go make a world-class knife. How did you get into this?
Well, I got into it, Rick. I'm a biologist by training, and I worked 11 years in the biology field. In doing research, I was the wildlife programs manager for St. Regis Paper Company for 11 years. And in that, we were looking into high-quality deer management. We had a 32,000-acre research area down in East Texas. And so we were collecting a lot of specimens, and we did a lot of necropsy work. And when we were doing that, of course, we're going through a lot of knives. I found that I just couldn't find the kind of a product out there in the marketplace at that time that I needed. And on an everyday basis, sometimes we were doing 15 or 20 deer. So I designed a cleaver that was about a quarter of an inch thick out of D2 steel with a rounded nose on it, so we could also do skinning with it. So we could take that animal apart pretty quickly. And as other hunters would see that, they'd go, man, I'd like to have one of those. And, the light bulb goes off.
Uh-huh.
And so once I determined that I wanted to go to Alaska and set up an operation in Alaska as an outfitter, I became a master guide in Alaska, a commercial instrument rated pilot. So I flew bush planes up there during that whole time.
Very
so
nice.
That's kind of how it started.
That's quite impressive. I mean, when you said instrument rated, it got my attention real quick.
Well, you want to be instrument rated when you fly in Alaska. I can promise you that.
Oh, yeah, for the fog and weather and stuff like that.
The fog and the snow and the rain and all of that. It's a challenging environment to fly in.
The joke here, I tell people, I'm IFR rated, and that stood for I follow roads.
That was our saying. Yeah, where we were, when you take off from the lodge that we established, when we went up there, my wife and I, we just drove a stake in the ground and said, we're going to put a lodge here. And we were 100 miles from the nearest town. So you would take off in the evening. You wouldn't see a light. You wouldn't see a road. You wouldn't see a fence, not a highline wire, I mean, for an hour. And there's lots of places in Alaska where you can do that, where you're isolated up there.
Beautiful. And if you're not a pilot, I don't think you'd understand what flying over water at night is like. Very treacherous. You lose your horizon, and you'll pile one in. That's
that's right. Yeah, I tried to avoid that.
I hope you do. Now, the knife you were talking about with the rounded edge for skinning and stuff, I think that's the first knife I ever saw. I was on a trip where we had some new outdoor writers, and we were trying to get them indoctrinated into how to do things right. And your company had sent in some of those knives, and I was duly impressed with that. And okay. I kept telling, pardon me?
I said, that was our Brown Bear Cleaver. That's what we named that.
Yeah.
That knife won Most Innovative American Design Knife in 1994 at the International Blade Show in Atlanta. And that's what really launched our company.
Oh, I can see why. I mean, I held them briefly. I kept telling Joe Arterburn, our camp boss, I said, man, if somebody leaves one of them behind, I'm going home with it. Because not only are they quality made, but that particular design is extremely functional.
It is. It's like having a little hand axe with you. You know, when you look back on all the old photographs of our ancestors when they were hunting and in the outdoors, even 50 years ago, but especially if you look at those photographs 100 years ago, those guys all had a hatchet or a tomahawk hanging off their side.
Right.
I mean, a small hand axe is invaluable in the field. And when we put that rounded nose on that cleaver, it turned it into a skinner as well as a chopping device.
That was genius. if you're the guy that thought of that, you're a genius. Otherwise, whoever that was, give them my compliments on that one.
Well, we had lots of interaction with lots of people, and lots of ideas floated back and forth, and that's what we came up with. And it was always a team effort.
Now, that leads me into a question about looking through your website and such. I noticed that a lot of your knives have very unique and distinctive designs to them. And I am guessing that was probably trial and error and a lot of people's input. But how do you go about settling on a design?
Well, we start here with a design in the plant. And we get ideas, and of course we know what we're going to be as a hunter and a biologist. I know what I'm going to be doing with this product. I know what I'm going to be doing with this knife. And we would make prototypes, heat treat them to their maximum capability. We would then take, let's say, a dozen or so of those prototypes to Alaska. And we always had five or six guides that worked with us, and give them out to the guides and go, hey, go out there, use them hard, tell us what you like, tell us what you don't like. We'll make changes as needed, and we want to come up with a good product. If it doesn't work, let me know. If it does work, let me know. And, of course, I'm right out there with them using it as well. And that's how we refined all of our designs. We don't make what I call the Hollywood specials, knives with weird protrusions on them and stuff that just doesn't make sense for what we do. Now, you know, those knives have a purpose. It's just not something that we make. We make knives that are made for serious outdoorsmen, hunters, fishermen, campers, guides. We have almost a cult-like following of people that take our knives into the field, Knives of Alaska.
Anybody that's really spent any time in the outdoors and is really a woodsman, I think does much of the same thing as this, what I'm going to say here, but I can almost tell a new guy coming into camp what his level of experience is and how good a woodsman he is by what knife he's carrying. If he's got some big Rambo-looking sawback thing on his belt, it's like, yeah, you ain't ever been here before, have you, son?
Yeah, I know what you're saying.
And when I picked up your knives, you know, they fit in your hand. They're designed for the task at hand, which is, you know, close quarter work. They're easy. You were so kind to send me this Alpha Wolf model, and I picked it up, and once I got my fingers into the grooves that are on the handle, this thing is now an extension of my hand. This is great. Looking forward to using
it. That's the way a knife is supposed to feel.
Yeah.
It's supposed to be comfortable when you use it. It's supposed to be effective. It should be made of high-quality steel, and that's what we use. We, you know, all of our products are all American-made and always have been. We have a combination of old-world craftsmanship and high-tech, and that's kind of the way I describe our company. And those knives are made with either D2 steel, which is a high carbon. It's not stainless, but it is almost stainless. It runs about 12.5% chromium, which you need to be 13.5% to be called a stainless. But it has a high carbon content, a high vanadium content, which makes the cutting edge last a long time. And that's what we're after in the field.
Yep.
One of the most frustrating things in the world is to be out there. You've dropped that that great animal. It gets dark, and you end up having to saw on to the field dressing, as opposed to just make nice slices and open the animal up, get your job done, and get that animal packed back to the camp.
I also have another knife you sent me. It's the Diamond Blade series, the Gourmet Series Chef Knife. Now, tell us a little bit about that, and particularly the edge on them.
Well, the Diamond Blade project was a long-term project, research project with Brigham Young University over in Provo, Utah. And the way that came about was our motto, our mission statement with Knives of Alaska, has always been finest quality outdoorsman's knives. So we were always looking to improve. How can you get a better steel? How can you make the knife more comfortable to use, more effective to use? And we came across some individuals out of Provo, out of the university, and they were dealing with ultra hard materials and a process called friction stir processing. And what this boiled down to through 6 years of research was we patented a process that we coined friction forging. And what we're doing, Rick, is we're doing forging. Forging, when it started, was probably some guy sitting around with a big rock and pounding the steel and refining the grain structure. Then it went to a handheld hammer, and then it went to trip hammers. And what we did was we took it to the next level. So we're using a very heavy-duty mill, and we're putting our steel, and not what's going to become the knife, on this mill, and we're exerting extreme pressure through a rotating tool. And I don't want to start losing you here because it can get pretty technical pretty quick. But the bottom line is, we're doing an extreme forging process. And what does that do for us? Well, that refines the grain structure of the steel. Well, why is that important? Well, forging, which has a great reputation among knife makers, forging produces a finer grain structured steel. And when you do that, you can elevate hardness without elevating brittleness. Now, that's the holy grail for a knife maker.
That's right.
Because if you can do that, it just becomes a matter of physics, and If you get that knife harder and it's not brittle, you can make that edge thinner, and it becomes our knives are actually the diamond blade knives are actually sharper than a razor blade, and they're thin and they cut like a banshee. Okay? But they're not brittle. And people say, well, if you've got a knife that's hard, it's got to be harder to sharpen. Well, if you make that knife very thin, but not brittle, where it won't chip, it's very easy to resharpen that knife, even though it's harder. And so we feel like we have achieved a holy grail, if you will, in knife making. Nobody else can do it. We don't have as many models, of course, in the Diamond Blade line as we do with Knives of Alaska. And they're much more time-consuming to make. So they're a bit more expensive. But, you know, one of that old saying, you get what you pay for.
Yep. We're going to have to take a break here, Charles. But when we come back, I got a couple more questions for you. So I hope you can stay with us. And folks, you stay with us, too. We'll be right back after these messages. Welcome back, everybody. We're talking with Charles Allen this morning from Knives of Alaska, and I've got a couple examples here in front of me, and these things are literally works of art. This the hunting knife you sent me, Charles, this thing is, I'm looking at it, and it is so gorgeous, I hate to even use it in the field. It's almost like I want to hang it up like a piece of art.
They're made to use and use hard, and we want to see it out there, because that's when you'll really appreciate it.
Well, I can...
We do make good-looking products, but they're all made to use.
I can do that, because my dad used to tell me... He said I could tear up a crowbar and a sand pile, so I'm tough on equipment.
Will you let me know if that happens?
Now, when I was in the camp where I first saw your knives and stuff, I noticed that Joe also had one of the old 10-type signs, like you used to see Winchester and Remington and all like that, and it was yours. It was Knives of Alaska, and the picture of you was apparently you were surprised by a Kodiak at very close range. Can you tell us about that?
Well, what happened there, it's an unfortunate situation, but I was guiding a hunter, and the hunter had brought along a camera guy, so he had a camera. And this guy was filming. We took a really nice big bull moose the day before. Then we were out brown bear hunting on the coast, the Gulf Coast of Alaska, in some sand dune country off the Sayu River, which is midway between Cordova and Yakutat, Alaska. A lot of brown bears in there. It was a bad day in that it was raining and sleeting, wind blowing sideways, and I put the hunter on a good brown bear, and he takes it and makes a perfect shot. It's all on film. And then my assistant guide said, hey, there's another one. And I looked off to our right, and the guy is, I didn't realize it, the guy is filming this whole thing behind me. And when I'd been through several. When you brown bear hunt, it's like riding a motorcycle. It's not a question of if, it's a question of when you're going to have a problem.
Yeah.
And this bear came around a sand dune. She had been laying down. It was a sow. Unfortunately, she had a cub. She was in a protective mode for the cub. And I knew immediately this was not a false charge. This was the real deal. And she picked me. And I told the guys, I mean, all this happened in, if you look at the video, it all happened in 5 seconds. And I turned my head and I said, you guys run. And I didn't want anybody around me. And I faced the bear, and it was coming full tilt. And a bear can outrun a quarter horse in the first 40 yards.
Yes.
And she was out about 100 yards when she started coming. I started hollering at the bear, hey, bear, hey, bear, jumping up and down, and that's when she locked in on me, and I knew it was going to be a bad deal. I waited until the last second. She came up on me. I shot her at 12 feet, I pulled the trigger, at the last second. But I've had two of my friends up there that have been mauled by brown bears. And it's not a pretty thing what happens to people when they get mauled by a bear.
Powerful animal.
Very, very much so. And it was unfortunate. It's called a DLP, a Defense of Life and Property. It was all on film. It used to be on, and I don't know if it is anymore or not, but it was, you could go on the YouTube and I think you could see brown bear attack, something to that effect. Anyway, it used to come up. I don't know if it does anymore. I try to put that out of my mind.
So, well, sorry to have you relive that, but I knew.
It was one of those unfortunate things that when you play that game up there, things can happen.
I'm glad you had enough rifle and a good enough aim to get the job done, Charles. You didn't get chewed up on.
Me too.
Where can people find your products? Let's get back to something a little more friendly.
Well, you can
friendly.
Go to knivesofalaska.com or diamondbladeknives.com. And they're there. We have a full line of hunting, fishing, and folding knives. We got into the folding knives really after we began making all of our fixed blades. We wanted to get into the folder market. And right now we're making some, probably in my, of course I'm prejudiced, we make, I think, the best automatic knife that there is out there. It's got a great safety, it's got a great spring, it's fast, it's made out of, great steel. And I'm a rancher down here in Texas. We raise Wagyu beef, and I got in the habit of carrying an automatic knife when I'm out there in the wintertime, especially feeding, and climb off the tractor and walk up to that big 2,000-pound bale of hay and just walk down the side of it with opening that knife with one hand becomes very attractive. And you get, once you get used to using a one-handed, an automatic knife, I wouldn't go back to any of my other folders. I just
yep.
really like them.
Yep. There's a lot handier and a lot more speed to it. So, Charles, I sure thank you for being on the show this morning and talking with me, and thank you for sending me a couple of your products to test out. I will stay in touch and let you know how these things go.
Well, thank you, Rick. It's been a pleasure, and have a great hunt this weekend.
I will try. I'll keep you posted on that as well. So,
all right.
That's it for this week, folks. We'll see you next time on another edition of the Outdoor Connection.